Welcome back to Word and Table, a weekly podcast, bi-weekly podcast, on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship, and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I am here, as usual, with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Hello, Alex, and again, Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America. And Father Stephen, we are, this episode, we're coming back around to our, you know, three or so episode cycle of talking about another father of the church. And this one is one that I've had the privilege of reading a bit. And that's Cyprian of Carthage.
A beloved figure of the church.
Yeah, is a third century bishop in Africa. So let's begin with, first of all, who is Cyprian and what does the church remember him for?
Sure. Cyprian is a martyr. And first we should say something about North Africa that sometimes surprises people because the area has changed so much. Is now we think of that as an Arab area, of course. You know,
right,
people speak Arabic
in Sahara,
you know, Tunisia, Algeria, those kinds of places. And actually, at the time, that wasn't true. That comes from the Arab invasions of the 7th century and things. Actually, then it was as Roman as Italy.
Right.
Actually,
yeah.
It was a little more Roman. This sort of surprises us, some people. Is remember Rome had was very strong prejudice in favor of Greek culture. Sort of like, you remember if you read Russian novels in the 19th century, Russians studied French.
Oh, yeah.
That was the prestige thing. They spoke French among each other, etc.
Sure.
Well, the Romans in Rome were that way. The Romans were big into Greek as their educated language and things. So the people in North Africa, it was a very Roman place, but they weren't that sophisticated. So their prestige language was actually Latin, their own language.
Right.
And so ironically, some of our best Latin writers and things came because North Africa was the heart of Latin as Latin.
Mm-hmm. And when we even when we say Africa in this time period, we're talking about a specific Roman province of modern-day Tunisia or something like that?
Tunisia, eastern Algeria, the north coast there. Right.
So when we say Africa, we wouldn't be referring to the entire continent at this
point. It's that coastal area. Again, it's the Mediterranean. It's band around. Think of a giant river area going all the way around.
Right.
It's band. That's the Roman North Africa.
So Cyprian of Carthage. So let's talk about Carthage.
Carthage was the famous city that was the great enemy of Rome.
Mm-hmm,
remember,
mm-hmm.
Carthage must be destroyed was the famous motto of Cato.
Right.
But it was the biggest city, you know, in North Africa, and it was a great center of Roman culture. And Cyprian, we're going to talk about his life, I think, in a minute. But Cyprian was the bishop of that city, and mm-hmm. He was the basically first among equals of all the bishops of Roman North Africa.
Okay.
You know, basically west of Egypt, west of Alexandria. You know,
kind
the Latin speaking.
Kind of bishops. The archbishop, quote unquote.
Exactly right. Sort of like our Archbishop Foley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has all the bishops. He had a sort of special pride of place in sense of a spokesman. He wasn't their but he was their spokesman. He would lead their councils and things. So
sure,
he was.
Sure.
He died a martyr. He was beheaded in 258. In the Valerian persecution, he lived through two persecutions.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that endears me to with his final beheading is they arrested him in a nearby town called Utica, and he escaped. He could, you know, why he escaped wasn't not to be martyred.
Mm-hmm.
He escaped because he thought Utica was away from the town where he's bishop, and he thought a bishop should set the example. People should see what it's like for somebody to bear witness to the faith.
Huh.
So he escaped back to the place where the police were.
Okay.
He went to Carthage, so he would be executed there.
He wanted to pick where he got executed.
Yes, he said, I want to be with my people. I think a bishop should die among his people.
Yeah. There's a bit of that, just a quick side trip. We see hints of that in certain martyrdom narratives, right? Like of Christians sort of making particular demands of their own executions, like Perpetua and Felicitas, you know, refusing the Saturnine garments that are given them.
Yes.
Like we're not being martyred in pagan clothes. You know, take these off and actually kind of calling the shots a little bit.
That's exactly right. It's a spiritual point.
Yeah.
What's really interesting to us is we actually have the legal description. We actually have the Romans' version of his execution.
Oh, wow.
So it's not just all the fond stories that we have, you know, people remembering, but we have actual civil records of his execution.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Great. So
and also he was one of the, I just say some of the reasons he was one of the most read Christian authors. Matter of fact, his publications in the West were almost as common as the New Testament at a certain time. They were, you know, as far as the number of copies that we find.
Okay.
And he was the number one authority in the Western Church prior to Augustine. If we had to think of who is the sort of patristic theologian in the West, we think, Augustine!
Yeah.
You know, but when it comes before Augustine, he would certainly be number one. He's a very important source of canon law. He's quoted forever in the Middle Ages and things. He's a beloved character. And one thing I think why it makes him so beloved when you read him is, first of all, his we'll talk about his background. I think I guess we have a little time later on. But what happened was he was a man of action. And so he's not, you know, he wasn't just a theoretician or something. All of his writings involve actual things going on in a living church.
Sure.
So not theoretical things. They tend to be very practical things. And he writes like a practical person to other practical people.
This marks, in my experience, this marks quite a lot of the earliest fathers. These were church men. These were people who were on the ground with regular laity and dealing with predicaments and problems.
And he's a remarkably, what shall I say, nice guy. I mean, sometimes, you know, we know about odium theologicum, you know, this sort of nastiness that can come in theological debate.
Sure, sure.
You don't really find that. He's stunning for his time to me, the degree to which he has that sort of erratic, that peaceful spirit.
Yeah, yeah. Which sets him off a bit from his mentor, right? But we'll get to that.
Oh yes, the two would never be confused.
Okay, so he's really important to our understanding of the church.
That's
today.
Probably the biggest thing is the result of all these various. It's funny sometimes in fighting off putting out fires, he gave us one of the most beautiful comprehensive understandings of the church.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into his life. Let's start at the beginning and give a bit of his background.
Well, he was born into a pagan family, somewhere between 200 and 210. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the very beginning of the third century in Roman North Africa. And he converts later on. He converts, basically in his mid-30s. He converted by a priest named either Caecilius or Caecilianus. We don't know his name exactly, but... Mm-hmm. He actually takes on one of his names. He adds his name of that priest in honor of the fact he's sort of his father and God.
Oh, really?
Sort of nice, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had excellent training, went to really good schools, and he was a rhetorician.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a professor speaker, which is in the Roman world was a really big deal.
That rhetoric was big in Carthage, right?
Throughout the Roman Greco-Roman world.
Okay, yeah.
That's the main reason we have the classics, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't for the stories, so you could improve your Greek and Latin.
I see. Okay.
That was the main reason you studied the classics, is to get the standardized official form of the language for public speaking.
So when we're talking about rhetoric, we're talking about increasing fluency and wit and being able to think on your feet. And
exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Something I need to learn.
I think you do beautifully. Well, it's funny, when he was converted in 246, Easter, we know that we have a record, 246 he was converted.
Mm-hmm.
He was so good at what he did that he actually became bishop in 248, 2 years later. And this probably caused some difficulties, because there were at least five priests who did not appreciate being sort of jumped over.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we'll see them later in the schism. It'll come after persecution, but there clearly was some resentment.
Okay, so they come back to haunt us.
Yes. One of them, Felicissimus, I love that name. Felix is the Latin word for happy.
Uh-huh.
Felicissimus means like most happy. So I think sort of English, Mr. Happy. Actually, for someone who's Mr. Happy, he doesn't seem too happy with the fact that he was passed over. He'll be a problem later on.
Yeah. For Cyprian.
Yes. So what happens then soon after he becomes a bishop is the persecution of the Emperor Decius.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of the really bad moments for the church.
Mm-hmm.
You see, up until the church had persecutions, but it was sort of like the persecution of Jews in Eastern Europe in the Russian Empire.
Yeah.
It wasn't systematic. What would happen, it was horrible. But like they call them pogroms with Jewish persecutions, is if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof, you know, you live next to these people, and then suddenly there's a riot, or people come through and burn your house down, and these things would happen. This would happen to Christians. There'd be local riots or things, but it wasn't standardized. When Decius became emperor, there were a lot of practical problems in the empire. He decided they had to have a unification campaign.
Okay.
So one way to get everybody good Romans was saying, no matter what religion you practice, he said everybody ought to offer a sacrifice to the gods. The emperor. Mm-hmm. So basically pray for the emperor and the empire.
So whatever your god, your own little god is, we're all going to get together and we're going to sacrifice to the Roman god.
You can do whatever you want, but the Romans were very syncretic that way. You know, they're willing to go with to allow a wide, but they thought that why should anybody object? We don't object to your gods. Why would you object to ours?
Yeah, yeah.
And so they actually ordered that everybody had to offer a sacrifice, and you had to have a certificate showing you did it, mm-hmm. called a labellus. It means just Latin for certificate, little book, certificate that you did it.
Yeah.
And so what happened? This caused a crisis. So some people could do is the full form would be you would actually bring your piece of meat to the pagan priest who would actually offer it. Then you'd eat it, uh-huh. and you would pour out a drink offering.
Sure.
And people who did it were called the sacrificati, the ones who had actually offered a sacrifice.
Uh-huh.
And some people, there's an easier, a milder form, which you could just offer some incense. You throw a handful of incense mm-hmm. on the fire. Mm-hmm. That would do. Okay. And what some people did is a beautiful thing in an authoritarian society is bribery can get around most problems.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Is they simply buy a certificate.
Okay.
Saying they had done something they hadn't done.
But this was doing any of those three things, that was off limits for Christians.
Absolutely,
right?
Off limits.
Okay, so you couldn't even kind of go up and throw in your pinch of incense and not really mean it or cross your fingers or something like that. Even that is not allowed by the church. Right?
Oh, no, it was a denial of the Lord.
That was fine with the procurator, the Roman government, right? You could, you know, mean whatever you want, right?
But yeah, just go through it. Like the Pledge of Allegiance or something. The idea was like refusing to say the Pledge of Allegiance was taken that way by the Romans.
Okay.
Like we think as Americans, somebody said, you know, when you say the Pledge of Allegiance, sometimes people get very upset about that.
Okay.
So it's really the witnesses. Yeah.
So it's really the church's, it's really the church that has a problem with this.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is indeed a huge problem. So
it's a huge problem.
The government is saying you have to do this. The church is saying you must not.
So what happens is, first of all, with Cyprian, we know he's a brave man for the rest of his life. But here at this time, he thought the best thing, since he was obviously the first person they're looking for, and they did this because they wanted to basically decapitate the church by getting its leadership.
Get the leadership out.
He went underground, off in his state, so he could still run things. So he kept in constant contact. We have the letters with the church, mm-hmm. you know, keep things going. He was criticized for some people later on for doing this.
Okay,
but he actually left in order to keep things going, to keep the church,
right.
So it wasn't decapitated during this persecution. What happens, though, here is a schism will follow, which is a break in the church, because various different things happened. First of all, the worst situation is some people, the minute they were told there would be a punishment, sort of ran down to the police station to offer the sacrifice, so to speak.
Oh, okay.
I mean, some people didn't have to be pushed. They weren't in any trouble.
They were, sure.
You know, so we had some people like this. Other people really were tortured and things. And after going through terrible tortures, they couldn't take anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave in. That was a different situation.
Uh-huh.
Some people just bought the certificates and said, well, we didn't actually offer anything. You know, so there are all sorts of people on the spectrum. But the question is, how do we deal with these people?
Mm-hmm.
And these were called the laps, the lapsi in Latin. Lapsus in Latin means simply to fall, mm-hmm. to fall down. The fallen ones. What do you do with these people? And it's sort of interesting because there's a schism, meaning a break in the church, in two places. Here, and another place is Rome.
Yeah.
Rome itself will have the same thing happen. What happens is the pope, the bishop of Rome, is named Fabian. He dies as a noble martyr.
Mm-hmm.
Fabian dies as a martyr. And what happens afterwards is people argue, what should we do about these people who weren't faithful?
Yeah.
And in Rome, what you have a man named Novatian who thought that the authorities were being too nice to these people because it was still very tough. You had to do public penance, and it was a very, very serious long-term thing. But they thought they were beyond the pale.
Sure.
So Novatian had this purer church.
Okay. So this is a situation basically where after this persecution is over, you've got, you know, everyone starts coming back to church. And
well, they want to come back to church.
Yeah. So, and some people have really gone through it and not compromised their faith. They mm-hmm. have been tortured. They've the ones that have survived, at least. But then you've got other people coming back who did capitulate.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously there's going to be some, is the issue that there's some, there's bad blood here, or there's feelings of, you know, wait a minute, it can't be this easy.
It doesn't, actually, it seems that's not the case.
Oh, okay.
More so. Actually, it's sort of counterintuitive because, ironically, let me tell you about the two schisms because they're exactly opposite.
Okay.
In Rome, the church breaks, and we have the first antipope. There are two people elected bishop of Rome. the real one, who is Cornelius, Pope Cornelius, and then a rival bishop. And they were the fact of saying that, no, this is wrong. The church is losing its purity. To let people like this, they betray the Lord. They're out of this. You know, they're fallen from grace. You know, that we have to keep the purity of the church.
Sure.
And in North Africa, it's exactly the opposite. There, ironically, the people who were tortured and things tended to take the side of the people who had lapsed and say, oh, give them a break.
No,
and saying, actually, who are you to be stricter than we are? We're willing to forgive these people. Why can't you?
So the confessors, the people that had been through it and hadn't capitulated, these guys start to gain a bit of authority, right?
That's really what the problem is going to be in Carthage. The problem is going to be that some of these people sort of liked being, instead of the church making disciplinary decisions, what's the best for this person? How do we reintegrate them? They're saying, hey, it's good enough for me. I was tortured.
Yeah.
You're good to go. I will give you communion as a priest.
So my life experiences give me the authority to say who's in and who's out.
Indeed, there were some people who tried to argue, it appears, that, you know, like we have a baptism of blood, the idea that, you know, that there was an ordination of blood.
They argue that if
they had been tortured and things, you know, that maybe that meant that they were part of the presbyterate.
When we talk about the baptism of blood, we're talking about how, Christians who are catechumens who hadn't been baptized yet, who were martyred before they had been baptized, they're considered baptized by their martyrdom.
Yes. Jesus talked about being baptized, you know, that way.
Okay, so the issue here is that, you know, confessors are in both places, whatever their decisions regarding the lapsed, they're starting to claim to apostolic authority that they don't have.
Right. I think it's really much more an issue of good church order, and also how seriously, you know, again, part of it wasn't the resentment. There was a real feeling that this wasn't right for them. I mean, this was a serious thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It had to be treated seriously. You know,
right.
Sin is serious.
Sure.
There's forgiveness, but it's not cheap grace.
Yeah, yeah. So okay, so he comes through. So how does Cyprian come into this controversy?
Well, Cyprian is actually in North Africa. The problem was he tries to restore church order by saying, "Look, there has to be discipline." So he came up saying there is possible for these people to be restored, but they have to go through some significant penance.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're on the point of death or something, of course they'll be restored immediately at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, and if they got better, let's say something, you know, then they're still in the church.
Yeah, yeah.
But basically, he comes across saying we have to have a tight discipline. It wasn't a rigorism. It was just saying it has to be serious, but it is real. You can get back into the church.
Yeah.
So it's a realistic path. But it is serious, as opposed to the laxists.
Sure, sure. So in Africa, he's saying, you know, we can't be too flip about this. Grace is not cheap.
And it's interesting that he supports Pope Cornelius in Rome, who's fighting a rigorist faction.
Right.
They're wrong to be fighting him on this. Yeah.
Sure. So Cyprian, basically, through this controversy, is defining church order.
And there's a sort of happy ending to this in a strange way, is all these people were sort of trapped in this period of penance. Another persecution breaks out soon thereafter with the Emperor Valerian, the one in which Cyprian himself will die, as will Pope Stephen. And in that case, they gave a general amnesty to everybody who was in penance anywhere, because they said they need the sacraments to be ready to give witness.
Okay, so
everybody, when the second persecution started, saying everybody in the process of penance is fully reintegrated into the sacraments, because you need to be with church. You need to be in the fellowship.
You need strength.
For what's to come.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Wow. That
brought unity.
Amazing.
That brought it all back together. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So the persecution divides the church, and then it brings it back together.
Yeah. And it's very strange. It solved the problem.
That's really fascinating.
One other thing I want to mention, though, another issue that came up is important, was the issue about what about heretics in baptism? You know, what if somebody's baptized by a schismatic, you know, a heretic or a schismatic, somebody who's not in the church?
Uh-huh.
When they join the church, should they be baptized, rebaptized?
Right.
In the grounds that doesn't really count if it's from that.
Uh-huh.
And Cyprian took a view, which is not what the church ultimately came to believe.
Okay.
Is he took the view that it didn't count You know, mm-hmm. that unless you're connected with the church, you know, a baptism outside of the church didn't count as a baptism.
Okay.
He was corrected by that way, you know, Pope Stephen in Rome said that's not the custom. You know, the custom is baptism is baptism.
Yeah.
And if you come, you know, it's like you treat like any baptized person. You, if they're restored to the church, you publicly welcome into the church with a laying on of hands.
Sure.
And you bring them in. So there, another thing there was the issue of again, that issue goes away, though. But one point he argued for was that his local custom, we'll talk more about that when we talk about the unity of the church.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's get into his writings, including on the unity of the church. Mm-hmm. So what was his style? We usually take a moment to talk a little bit about how these guys wrote.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There are three different things when you look at his writings, and a lot of them, there are 13 big treatises, plus mm-hmm. he has 81, there are actually 65 letters he himself wrote.
Yeah.
And here's what I can tell you. As far as, first, there's one thing like a school job, like somebody getting a high school term paper. There's obviously an early thing he did that it's called that the idols are not gods. It sort of really is like a high school. I mean, it's just not up to his. It's obviously a first effort.
Okay, so this is like a 10th grade paper.
It's later in his compilation. It's an early thing. So, okay. But everyone's critics think it's got to have been a really early thing before sure. he got into his flow. And one of the things, he did something sort of like his version of how I became a Christian, sort of his version like of Augustine's Confessions, but not on that level. And that he's sort of a little highfalutin, tried to imitate some, like Tertullian was that way, very flowery mm-hmm. type of person in his writing. But then he comes to be the Cyprian you love.
Okay.
He writes this clear, just beautiful, easy to understand, practical Latin.
Okay, yeah.
That made him beloved of the Latin-speaking world.
Okay, so he kind of takes a little bit to come into his own as a writer.
It's pretty quick, but when he does, he really embraces that style.
Okay, and you could it's a plain, straightforward sort of style, but that's nonetheless beautiful or well phrased. Yeah,
you know, it's very clear. Mm-hmm. You know, they're different. You know, it's. If you've ever read like Victorian novels or something, it's just so over the top.
Right, yeah.
A lot of Latin rhetoric was like that, very, very flowery, and he wrote it in a way we just consider just really just beautiful, good, clear language.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, beautiful clarity.
Okay.
Not, you know, just a business type. It's a beautiful clarity. That's one of the reasons he's so beloved in the Latin-speaking world. It was just so good.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about his he wrote treatises and letters. Let's talk about his treatises first.
Well, we mentioned the idols are not God. It's interesting. This is his first effort, like his high school effort. He's saying, well, you know, probably the pagan gods were actually originally just kings who got these stories attached to them and sort of got promoted.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
He said, after all, we know there's only one God. Then he writes a treatise to Donatus, which I said is sort of like his personal confession, simply saying, here's how I became a Christian. But it's not as personal, really, as Augustine. Okay. So it's don't expect Augustine's Confessions.
Sure.
Then we get he wrote something, Tertullian, who was the great original Latin author.
Yeah.
Tertullian wrote the thing, what do you do? How should the virgins dress in the church? I mean, people with professional, you know, professional celibates, you know, with females, okay. How should they dress? And he basically writes his own simplified work of like Tertullian. Then they get that he really comes into his own. He wrote something called Concerning the Lapsed. And again, the beautiful thing is how he balances the two. He's neither a rigorist nor a laxist. He's just talking about, you know, a healthy discipline.
Yeah.
You know, we got to take this seriously, but we have to remember people. I mean, it's a good essay. And then his masterpiece, one of the things you just have to read, if you read one thing, has to be on the unity of the church, his most important work.
I'm pleased to say that I have read it.
So, good man.
Yes. I'm very good.
And it's a good read.
It's a good read. Yeah. I recommend the latest popular patristics translation. But
And St. Vladimir's Press. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend that. Another thing, the Lord's Prayer. And he talks, he goes through the various petitions. What I think is really neat about the Lord's Prayer, something people still quote him on, is that he emphasizes the corporate aspect of prayer. As Christians, we always pray together. Even alone, he says, you know, when you're in your room, you don't say, my Father in heaven. It's our Father.
Yeah.
Give us this day our daily bread.
Mm-hmm.
It's always corporate.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things we learn in the Our Father, he tells us. That lesson, Christians for centuries have reminded people of that.
So that the church is always there.
Yeah. When we pray, we are the church. Mm-hmm. We pray as church. Hmm. Another thing he reminded us again of the fact that the ancient tradition of praying the Lord's Prayer at basically mid-morning, noon, and mid-afternoon. Mm-hmm. So he actually talks to us again, like Tertullian did, about that custom. Then he had to Demetrianus, and this is interesting. This is explaining natural disasters. You know, when you come back to this, have you ever read City of God by Augustine? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of Romans were saying, the reason everything's going bad right now is because those Christians. You know, when we were good Roman pagans and doing...
The gods were happy with us.
The gods are not amused.
Yeah.
And so what he really does is gives an apology and an explanation. That's not so. And he says, first of all, I love this. He gives sort of a natural explanation. He said, there are natural reasons why bad things happen. Who knew?
Yeah.
And then he said...
That's aged well.
He said, also another thing, he said, besides that, he said, if we're going to talk about divine wrath, it's on you for your bad conduct and for persecuting Christians.
Yeah.
It's not the pagan gods. Mm-hmm. Then he has something on morality. This is a response to the plague. There was a plague that, never rains but it pours. After the Decian persecution, there's a great plague.
Right.
And he is talking about Christians, about an appropriate response to death. Mm. And he said, you're not like other people. How does hope look like with people who are facing death? It's a good work. Something called Concerning Works and Almsgiving. And this is about plague relief.
Yeah.
It's about, people stepping up to the plate about, a lot of people needed help as a result of the plague. The advantage of patience. And I love that he talks about the example based on both God the Father and Christ as models of patience. Mm. Jealousy and envy, and this is neat. He said the danger of jealousy and envy is we sort of consider them junior varsity vices.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're
we could do better.
Yeah, we all.
Character flaws.
Sure.
And he said, we have it backwards. And he says, here's why. He said, think about it. How did Satan himself fall? Through jealousy and envy of God. Mm-hmm. And he says, this also destroys the church. This is what brings schism.
Yeah,
it's our pride in things that bring this in. So that's an interesting take on it, I always thought.
Yeah,
that is. It's a really neat thing. We tend to think of it as like a sort of a character flaw. I could do better. And he said,
right.
This is deadly stuff. Fortunatus, Exhortation to Martyrdom. This is really important for people who study the history of the Latin Bible. The classic Latin Bible is called the Vulgus. Mm-hmm. And the Vulgus comes from Latin. The Vulgus means common people. Regular Latin, everybody could read. And by Jerome, it's a masterpiece.
Right.
But before that, there was something we called the Vetus Latina, which is the old Latin Bible. And how we know about it is what he did. You love this. He had a collection of biblical quotes that were meant to be inspiring. These are things you could use and meditate on topics. So he had a collection on key biblical texts on the theology of martyrdom. Mm-hmm. What real life really was, why it's to our advantage. And this is one of our best evidences of the old Latin Bible, because quotes taken from it.
Wow.
And also, he had to Quirinius, he has three books of testimonies, again, which are basically large collections of related Bible verses on a topic.
Yeah.
One topic was explaining the truth of Christianity for those who are still thinking that Judaism was the true form of a compendium on Christology. What do the scriptures teach us about the person of Christ and Christian virtues?
So we've got some biblical theology here as well.
His stuff is so readable. Mm. I mean, it's really, it's good stuff to read.
Especially if one reads Latin, right?
There's some very good English translations now, the St. Vladimir's Press. Called Popular Patristic Series is good.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so those are his treatises that we have.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of letters, too.
They're almost better in some ways because they're some of our best witness. I love letters and journals because they're live on the scene. They're contemporaneous.
Yeah.
It's not like later on, years later, looking back and remembering. I love contemporaneous things. He has 65 letters, and we have another 16 that were written to him.
Okay. Yeah.
And they're from important people, at the time. So we're right in the middle of these. And they're basically four groupings. 38 were during that persecution of Decius. Letters to the church. Hey, continuing to direct the church. During that schism that we said in Rome with Novatian, he had 12 letters there. 10 on the baptismal controversy with some of them with Pope Stephen, and then on some balance on various miscellaneous topics.
Okay, so we've got a good corpus from
good
this guy.
Corpus.
That's really cool.
And I got to tell you, I think there's probably no church father in some ways who's easier to read than in the sense that he's just very accessible. Maybe because it's just always practical stuff.
Okay, so what do we get theologically from what remains of Cyprian?
Well, the biggest thing, no doubt, is he has this. Our bishop here in the Diocese of the Upper Midwest, it's this big discovery when we find out the church is a she, not an it. Mm, the bride of Christ. It's a really big, that's why bishops wear a ring to remind them that they're wed to their diocese, wed to the church. And so his ecclesiology, some of the lines, he said, for example, there's no salvation outside the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's talking about the fact is, you know, again, salvation, you know, is the church is the body of Christ. That's where we emphasize that importance. He says it's impossible to have God as your father and not have the church as your mother. That quote we've heard, that's from Cyprian. Mm-hmm. He's the one who came with that quote. He said the church is like the seamless garment. Remember that they had to cast dice for because you can't tear it apart. You destroy it.
The church is a
seamless. It's Noah's Ark. He said the only place if you're going to be saved, it's going to be in the Ark.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's got some typological connections there.
He gave us the image, by the way, the ship is being, the church being a ship in the storm with the bishop as the pilot. For someone who went through two persecutions, you can understand that.
I was about to say he really lived that out.
And one thing I love for... he compares mother church is to a mother just embracing this big mother of a big family, having all her children in her big embrace.
Yeah.
He uses that image 30 times.
Wow.
Mother church loving her children, embracing her children.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
He says the bishop is in the church and the church is in the bishop. Again, that focus we had like Ignatius is where can we find that body of Christ? What's our sure sign, our sacrament that we found it?
Uh-huh.
He says the bishop.
Yeah, you got to find the bishop.
The bishop, in connection over time and across space.
Right.
When he talks about Matthew 16, he emphasized, remember, the powers given to Peter are given to all bishops, all the other apostles, in saying, emphasizing that that each of those bishops having the fullness of that power.
Right, right.
Now, sometimes people have tried. There's been a lot of controversy as he supports Stephen, and he writes some things particularly. He says it's ironic to this group in Rome that had revolted.
Mm-hmm.
Is the reason Peter is done first is he's the spokesman. He's a sign, a visible sign of unity of all the bishops. They have a common authority, but he's the visible sign of unity.
Yeah.
Guys, isn't it sort of strange that in the very city, the sign of unity?
Yeah.
But sometimes people have tried to make that sound more like he's arguing for a papal legislative primacy. Uh-huh. I don't think the text bears it out for several reasons. First of all, he emphasizes in various writings that all bishops have equal power in their own diocese.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, he actually cites Paul's dispute with Peter.
Yeah.
You say, Peter didn't just say, hey, Paul, here's, Paul laid down the law to Peter.
Right,
when he got out of line, remember, in Galatians.
Yeah.
And his own dispute with Stephen of Rome, he disagreed and never gave in.
Right.
On the baptism. So it wasn't like, well, gee, the Pope in Rome said something, I guess he must be right.
Mm-hmm.
So to take, given his history, I think it's really unfaithful to the bulk to argue this as an argument that I think he'd be more first among equals. Yeah.
And that's a really helpful balance too, right? Between the where is the church? Well, the church is the bishop, and the bishop has the authority in his own diocese, but also all the bishops together in the council,
right?
And across time and space. So it's not just this shift to kind of local independent.
Oh no, no, yeah, bodies, it's the bishops together in the right hand fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
With baptism, again, he erroneously rejects the baptism of heretics.
Right, right.
But he does one interesting thing here is he explicitly tells us about baptism of blood. He specifically refers to it. With penance, again, he's against the two extremes, laxity or that he has a beautiful. And also, what's interesting, we talked about the sacraments of the church or sacramental rites. He gives us the three components that later became the three essential components of confession.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's the one who gives it to them. Confession, satisfaction, I mean, you have to make things right, and reconciliation, which, formally the granting, restoration.
Well, that was certainly a pressing concern for him in his time.
It was a very pressing practical concern. And with the Eucharist... it's emphasized, it's he talks about its sacrificial character. Again, we're not talking about it like separate sac, but the idea that we join ourselves to that one sacrifice of Christ. Mm-hmm. We join in Christ's offering of himself to the Father.
Okay, wow. Yeah, that's a pretty rich foundation. I can definitely see how he would have been, the Augustine of his time, as it were.
Very beloved figure. And again, there's some people you read and you love.
Yeah.
I mean, you love them. You just can feel when you're in their writings that I like this guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're going to feel that way about Cyprian. You'll see when you start reading him at all, you're going to love him.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there's a lot here for Anglicans to like.
I can see.
The unity of the church, built on the authority of the bishops in their diocese and working together. That's the vision, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and it carried him and the church through really, really tumultuous times.
We'll make him an honorary Anglican.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Father Stephen. That is all the time we have left for this episode. And thank you for listening to Word and Table. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more on liturgy, sacraments, and the great tradition of Christian worship. Thanks for listening.